and welcome to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Today, we continue our look at unions and collective representation. With work conditions increasingly precarious and with rising inequality, why do trade unions seem to have such a stunted future? Here's some of what we heard last week.
For young workers under 25 years of age in Australia, only about 6% of them belong to a union versus about, say, 15% for the workforce as a whole. And there's a number of reasons why the union presence among young workers is even lower. One of them is the fact that young workers are the stormtroopers, if you like, of this casual, precarious labor market that we're creating. They are the ones who confront immediately the fact that there's no permanent full-time stable jobs anymore. If you want to work, you're going to get a gig. You're going to get a few hours here. You're going to get a casual job there. You're going to do labor hire work there. That's the reality of most young workers, and those are situations where it's hard for unions to get a foothold.
At the same time as a range of policies were introduced that increased inequality, that cut tax rates for the wealthy, that in general promoted these developments, the same people introducing these policies were also consistently introducing policies that made union organisation more difficult, that made union officials more subject to criminal liability, that limited strikes, along with ad hoc things like royal commissions and so forth. And so what we've seen has been 30 or 40 years in which almost every piece of legislation affecting the labour force has been calculated to reduce the influence of unions, to make unions' life more difficult. So one could reasonably say, you know, we've seen policies that produce inequality, policies that drove unions down, the same people pushing both sets of policies, there isn't a mystery here. There's probably more to it than that, but that's certainly a pretty good starting point.
People continue to think about 21st century problems with this 20th century thinking that it's sectors and skill groups. And I think to a large extent, the unions, just along with the governments, are still trying to think about this globalization like the old one and haven't realized that it's going to require quite different organizations. But so many countries, so many governments, and so many labor unions are still focused on industry means factory jobs that they haven't been able to think beyond that. So I think to a certain extent, it's a lack of imagination. The other is that this fragmentation and the fact that globalization is affecting people more individually makes it much harder to organize, and therefore it may be technologically more difficult to organize labor. I suspect that once we get over this gig economy shock, that the gig economy workers will start to organize in some way or another and demand worker rights, but just right now they haven't got there because I fundamentally think they're misthinking the impact of globalization on the economy.
And if you missed that episode, it is available to podcast or stream from the Future Tense website. So what needs to change for collective representation in the workforce to have greater relevance in the future? Professor John Quiggin from the University of Queensland.
Well, in the Australian context, I think the tie to the Labor Party has proved really toxic for both groups. It's very convenient for the personnel. One of the typical career paths is, you know, a bright university graduate joins a union as an organiser, representing people who do jobs that this person has probably never done, then proceeds into Parliament, and then, if they're successful enough, reaches the ministry in their 40s and then goes on to a job in a bank later on. Now, that kind of career path is very satisfactory for the people involved, and so it's unsurprising that union officials and Labor Party see a big benefit in staying together. But when we look at the way in which, on the one hand, yeah, the Labor Party has really gone along with all the kind of market liberal policies which have led to the decline of unions. On the other hand, the way in which this compromises unions in the eyes of people who may not support the Labor Party, lots of working class people who don't support the Labor Party. So, yeah, that tie, I think, is something which ought to be broken in the interests of both parties.
What about the nature of the sort of staff that are employed by unions?
Well, the traditional model, of course, was that people came up from the shop floors. And there's obviously a problem with going back to that. When you say the shop floor, we have an image dating somewhere back to the middle of last century. There really isn't a shop floor anymore in that same sense. But it certainly seems as if a more organic union movement would be developing from people who were in the sector the union represents. And indeed, in my perception, the parts of the union movement that have done best, the white-collar public sector unions, the officials of those unions seem much more likely to come from that same background than do, you know, for example, the officials of the shop assistants union.
And that's a criticism that's often labelled at political parties, isn't it? That almost that there's this sort of professionalisation of the high ranks of political parties And then also of trade unions.
Yes, and I think the political party system is cracking under the strains of this. We don't have a particularly good answer to it because political party membership has decayed in the same way. But very clearly the willingness of the public to vote for random people of various kinds is an indication that the professional political class isn't doing a great job. And of course, increasingly, of course, the workforce consists of professionals. So we don't want to over-exaggerate this part of the story. But there's no doubt that if we had moved to a more activist model in which lots of people played a part-time role in the nature of, you know, the kind of organisations we see, things like GetUp, where they have lots and lots of members who aren't turning up to meetings every month and may not be, you know, individually may not be doing that much, they still seem to be very effective organisations compared to the kind of model of full-time officials working on dues paid by members who do very little.
And full-time officials who were often there for very long periods of time.
Well, and of course that's been true ever since unions existed. You've had union bosses who've held on power for many decades, but it certainly does seem to be more and more of a problem in an era where those kinds of very long-term arrangements are the exception rather than the rule. And it does, I guess, undermine the view that these people are in some sense democratically elected representatives when we see, you know, very few people survive very long in proper electoral politics. So if somebody can stay in a position of union secretary for 30 or 40 years, there certainly seems to be a problem with the degree to which that organisation is really a democratic, responsive kind of organisation with an active membership.
I suppose looking to the future, I mean, is it inevitable that there will be some kind of public demand for a new type of representational organisational body in the future?
Well, certainly the public demand's there. And of course, as unions have pushed things out of that sphere and into political debate, with the Work Choices campaign in 2007 and the recent dispute over penalty rates, those haven't been fought in the traditional mould of mass meetings and workers going on strike and so forth, but in the political sphere, we've seen that there's a lot of public support there. And of course, that's what propelled unions into politics through the Labor Party 100 plus years ago. So I think that move back into the public political sphere is inevitable. How that's played out organisationally is unclear. But again, I think in the Australian context, at least, the tie to a specific political party, I think, is something which really belongs in the past.
John Quiggin from the University of Queensland. Staying with the Australian context, and Dr. Jim Stanford, the director of the Centre for Future Work at the Australia Institute, says nothing is likely to change as long as what he terms the free rider effect continues.
We have to have a situation where if people are going to benefit from the activities of unions and collective bargaining, whether it's through their workplace agreement or through the work of unions in lifting minimum standards and the awards and so on, there has to be some system that supports the unions as an institution and their ability to do that. There's lots of models to choose from. It could be a European type of structure where you have works councils that are set up in every major employer that the employer has to support as a way of solidifying the collective bargaining relationship. In some jurisdictions, if you're covered by a union contract, you're not required to join the union per se, or even necessarily to pay union dues, but you have to pay something that reflects the cost of the services and protection that you get from the union. So it could be called a fair share fee or a representation fee, so that it's deducted from their paycheck as long as they're covered by the employment agreement or the enterprise agreement. So it's a kind of a compromise, if you like, between the pure individual free rider situation that we have in Australia today and a sort of a full closed shop situation where you have to be in the union if you want to work there. Even in the fair share model, it's still a collective choice. You know, these are ultimately democratic decisions in the sense that the workers in a workplace decide by majority rules that, yes, we want to have a union, we want to have the benefits that come with the union, and we will collectively pay to ensure that that happens. That happens in the business world all the time, Anthony. Think about a corporation. A corporation is nothing other than a collective of individual shareholders who make votes by majority rules, and if the majority decides to spend money on something, every shareholder has to pay their share towards it. Or a strata that operates an apartment building. Same deal. If you're going to buy a unit in that, you're required to pay into the strata and abide by the majority decisions. That same logic should apply to collective bargaining and representation in workplaces, but because of the anti-union goals of the regulation, they're somehow treated as different. So there's ways, different ways to do it. But what is clear is that if we don't address that sort of free rider paralysis that's undermining the viability of unionization in Australia, then density and the influence of unions is going to continue to erode.
Jim Stanford also believes there's a need to modernise the structures of collective bargaining to better reflect the 21st century workforce. The National Wage Report, released in August 2016 by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, estimated that almost one in three Australian workers was now employed part-time. While around 90% of all new jobs created in the Australian economy in the 12 months to July 2016 were either part-time or casual.
We have to give casual and labour hire workers, I think, more rights, including the right to have collective representation, even dealing with the labour hire firms themselves. There's terrible exploitation where labour hire companies will charge their clients, say, $40 or $50 an hour for the labour that they supply, but only pay the workers sometimes half of that. And so giving labour hire workers more power to negotiate with the labour hire companies and or regulatory constraints on how the labour hire companies treat the workers that they've mobilised would be another approach. Same goes with the gig economy and platform type of work. I think we need clarity in the regulations that those people, you know, even if they're not showing up in a particular workplace each day, they are still de facto employees of those companies, and those companies have to have some obligations, including the obligation to negotiate with them collectively.
Welcome to Uber. Drivers are our most important partners, and we appreciate all you do to keep Uber running smoothly. Let's get started. As a driver with Uber,
even though we get a lot of hype about how this gig economy model is so new and exciting, most of the features of working in the gig economy are actually not new at all, and we have seen them for generations. Things like working on demand, where you don't have a regular job, but you just work when you're required. Things like supplying your own capital equipment or your own tools, or for Uber drivers, supplying your own car. Getting paid by a piecework system rather than paid by the hour. Those features have been around for a long time, and unions will have to continue to be creative because some of the new situations, you know, the Ubers and the digital platforms and so on, are going to require different ways of collective representation. But they, I think, ultimately are going to benefit from collective representation, and workers are going to find ways to do it, like a Facebook group for Uber drivers, for example, and other ways where they can communicate with each other, negotiate with a collective voice with Uber or whoever the employer is. So I'm optimistic that unions will be open-minded about finding some of those new structures. In fact, I see it in Australia as well as in other countries of that experimentation and innovation going on. But we do need a supportive institutional environment to support those efforts. Otherwise, it's going to be very hard for them to be viable in the long run.
And getting that supportive institutional environment relies in large part on putting public pressure on politicians, regulators, and employers themselves, just as traditional unions did early last century.
Restaurant food delivered to your door in 35 minutes. That's what Deliveroo is all about. The company insists its riders are self-employed and that they want to be. Flexibility is part of the appeal of the job. But when ITV...
I'm here on day three of an industrial action by Deliveroo scooter drivers, cyclists. The major grievance is this. Effectively, you're going from a sub-living wage, once you include costs and so on, to piecework. Now, the works are saying that it's going to be £3.75 per job.
This protest by gig economy workers in the UK is unusual, but far from unprecedented.
Uber, partner,
best idea ever.
Be your own boss. Make your own schedule. Work when you want to work. Don't work if you don't feel like it.
But today we're going to talk about, am I still driving for Lyft and Uber? So if that's something...
A lot of people are thinking it's really profitable, but some drivers are catching on that it's not. And so this is
social media platforms like YouTube are also being used by people to counter company spin around the amount of money you can make in a gig economy job, even though you'll receive very few, if any, traditional worker entitlements like holiday pay or sick leave. And despite the difficulties in providing union representation to casual and part-time workers, some established unions do see an opening.
I can tell you that people join the Canadian Freelance Union because they want to build the union movement. They want to get additional work. They want access to benefits. And they want to end the isolation.
Leslie Dyson's organisation is specifically focused on freelance workers in the media industry, a sector which continues to face massive change and where full-time employment is rapidly becoming a thing of the past. She's the union's president. She admits there are challenges.
We offer a political voice on freelancer issues. We provide access to a press card provided by our own union and also the International Federation of Journalists. We offer seminars and webinars, avenues for finding work, including with other unions. We have an online member directory that we distribute, and we offer grievance support, contract advice, access to benefits. And most importantly, probably, is the social and professional connections, taking people out of isolation.
What about the sort of industrial side of it? What about collective bargaining, that kind of thing? Is that possible in a situation where you've got people who are, you know, by definition, freelancers?
So it could be possible. We could have voluntary agreements with some forward-thinking employers. And the goal for all of our members is a collective agreement. But it is very difficult. The bigger we become, then the more leverage that we have. So I think a lot of people would like the protection of a union, but it is becoming increasingly difficult. So the CFU, the Canadian Freelance Union, is advocating for a number of changes, government legislative changes. In Ontario, there was a commission that was set up to look at precarious workers, looking at if the government is serious about this growing number of workers who are in this position, then there are some changes that need to be done to acknowledge their working conditions.
So is it the case then? I mean, does the situation have to get worse before it's going to get better in terms of worker representation in the employment force?
I would like to believe that it's as worse as it can get. We have a situation where we have older workers who work in the area of media and communications. They are having a real struggle right now because it's hard for them to hold on to their jobs. Employers find them very expensive and are laying them off. We have younger workers, younger members, who are highly skilled and highly educated, carrying an enormous student debt, and they can't even get their foot in the door. I don't know how much worse it has to get. Everybody can get this sense that these issues are not being addressed, that there is a very unlevel playing field right now. Employers are taking advantage of legislation that enables them to hire people on a contract basis. We know the employers that are abusing contracts, that are abusing the labor code because there isn't the enforcement. Governments aren't putting the money into and just enforcing the labor codes that actually exist.
What are some of the steps that organizations like yours have to take over time in order to not only increase your membership, but also be more effective as an advocate?
Well, there's a couple of things that are happening here, and I don't know if it's similar in other countries, but in Ontario, for example, this commission was set up to look at the situation of precarious workers and vulnerable workers, and there are some possibilities. They have sector councils. For instance, they have one for construction, and it sets minimum standards based on a collective agreement that everybody has to receive. The same could be applied to freelance workers. On the national level, we have the Status of the Artist Act, and that was tested recently. And in 2015, artists who were commissioned by the National Gallery were invited to exhibit their work, and the artists were able to bargain collectively with the gallery to ensure minimum standards for all the artists. Something like that could possibly be applied to freelance workers. For example, all the social media companies in a particular center could perhaps have a minimum standards that would apply to all media workers working for those particular companies, a minimum standard. So we can get out of this continually downward spiral, that there could be minimum standards for the people who are doing the, you know, photography, videography, writing, editing, web development, web design, all of those kinds of services could be covered in a particular area. So those are the kind of things that we're looking at that we think could be not just applicable to us, but acceptable to some of the jurisdictions.
Is part of the issue a suspicion of, you know, the traditional trade union movement? Is that one of the factors that influences people not to seek membership with the union?
I don't think that that's something that we're coming up against. We're a community chapter of Unifor. Unifor has 300,000 plus members across the country, and we're a community chapter of that. This model is very new, and I think it was started in 2014. And so we are given great independence and flexibility, so we can be really responsive to issues. We don't have a lot of interference from Unifor, our parent union. However, we can tap into all the experience, skills, and power of such a large union. So we have relatively low union dues, $125 per year. And some of our membership is somewhat fluctuating, and there's various reasons for that. I don't think it's because people don't want to belong, but when you're a freelance worker, you know that sometimes it can be a long time in between assignments. And some of our members go on and find full-time employment and or are covered by a union agreement and no longer need the Canadian Freelance Union. So there are issues like that. I think a lot of workers would appreciate some kind of stability, some kind of grievance procedure, some kind of steady benefits, pension contributions, all that sort of thing. I don't hear this criticism of unions so much anymore.
Leslie Dyson from the Canadian Freelance Union. You're listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. The industrial relations system that developed in the English-speaking world from the late 1800s onwards was built on confrontation. Workers on the one side and bosses on the other. But does it have to be that way in the future? Jean Duplessis is a professor of corporate law at Deakin University and an expert on the management participation system known as co-determination.
The idea of co-determination comes from the German model where shareholders and employees jointly appoint people to what is called a supervisory board, and that supervisory board is responsible for appointing the management board. And in that way, once again, it's a co-determination between the shareholders and the employees, with the interests of the employees almost constantly taken care of, rather than just once every 3 years through enterprise agreement negotiations in a very combative form through the unions.
So the idea, according to Professor Duplessis, is that if organised labour organisations are no longer able to effectively guarantee decent employment standards, then introducing a co-determination system into a country like Australia could provide one solution.
It's different from our model where the shareholders play the dominant role. There is co-determination between labour, which brings in labour, and the shareholders that bring in capital. I would just like to explain the German model in order to explain to our listeners where the employees will be involved in the German two-tier board system. So, first of all, the Germans has got a supervisory board and they have a management board. The supervisory board is responsible for supervising or overseeing the business of the corporation. And on that supervisory board, up to half of the members of the supervisory board consist of employees. The supervisory board is responsible for appointing the management board. And the management board is the board that would do the day-to-day management. So what is quite unique is that in the German law, the managerial activities and the managerial powers are exclusively powers of the management board, whereas the supervisory powers or governing powers are exclusively the powers of the supervisory board. They cannot interfere with each other's powers, but you can imagine if the supervisory board, with up to half of the board consisting of employees, if they appoint the management board immediately, from that first moment, the employees have some input as to who will manage the business of the corporation. So in that sense, at the highest level, their interests are in actual fact represented and they get an influence over matters later on. They can't interfere with the management board's powers, but the management board would hardly ignore wishes or guidance from the supervisory board, as they would know that, first of all, they need to be reappointed by the supervisory board, with half of it employee representatives and the other half shareholder representatives. And then the two boards, under normal circumstances, work together very collaboratively. The management board will even attend supervisory board meetings if things are not too sensitive or confidential, but they will also meet independently to keep an independent governance or supervisory role or have supervisory powers over the management board.
So does co-determination not just give employees, you know, a say in the culture, I guess, of the organisation or company, but does it actually decrease the amount of tension between management and also the workers because the workers are involved at this higher level?
Anthony, without any doubt, it does. And the way in which I would like to explain this is the contrast with the unitary board model that we have. Our negotiations in our unitary board system would normally be by way of enterprise agreements or EBAs, as they were called in the past. So these enterprise agreements are normally concluded every 3 years. So there's a period of massive conflict between management, the unions, to get an enterprise agreement sorted out. They normally say that CEOs last about 2 or maximum 2.5 enterprise agreement sessions, and then they step down because it's massively stressful for all parties. In the two-tier board system, there's constantly, not every 3 years, but there's constantly the interaction between the employees on the supervisory board and the management board who would attend sessions of the supervisory board. So it is a continuous process of collaboration, of testing the waters, of taking into consideration the interests of the employees. And then, of course, there are also enterprise agreements, but it's been done on a continuous basis, refining it and looking after the needs of the employees. And in that way, once again, it's a co-determination between the shareholders and the employees, with the interests of the employees almost constantly taken care of, rather than just once every 3 years through enterprise agreement negotiations in a very combative form through the unions.
Given that there is so much conflict within the sort of industrial relations landscape with countries like Australia and the UK, is it realistic to see this kind of co-determination coming into favour because of that sort of entrenched system of conflict?
Well, if we start off with the entrenched system of confrontation, I mean, I think we should not necessarily say that is a good thing. Even though it is entrenched, we should not say, well, that is the sort of model that we should continue having. But the other important point, of course, is we are moving away from the idea that all companies should just strive to make profits for shareholders. And that concept or that idea in itself, that companies are no longer there only to maximize profits for the shareholders, that in itself dictates that we need to think about other ways to look after the interests of other stakeholders. And one of the most important other stakeholders groups is indeed the employees. So in that sense, it would dictate that this model will get more and more attention. This is one of the only ways, in a gradual way, in which we can move away from what is, as I said, the shareholder primacy model to a more stakeholder-based model. And that's what the company lawyers and corporate governance specialists, that's what we are struggling at the moment. How do we get the interests of other interest groups, like employees, like creditors, like customers, also recognized in the formal company law model that we have, because the model is broken at the moment.
Sean du Plessis, Professor of Corporate Law at Deakin University. Karin Savanovitz is my co-producer here at Future Tense. Our sound engineer this week, Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time.